then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, your vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be, in the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One word more for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night, many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's May the 5th, 2011. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest.
There beside the singing river, that dark mass of men were seen, far above their shining weapons on their own beloved green. Death to every foe and traitor, forward strike the marching tune.
I'm going to hold off on my usual Edgar Steele update for now. I know I usually put it at the beginning of the show, but the trial is in progress in Boise, Idaho, and I haven't gotten any updates yet on what happened in the courtroom on Monday. I do this show in segments over a period of 2 and sometimes 3 days, and so what I'm going to do this week is hold off until the last part of the podcast before I talk about the Steele case. The big news, of course, is that Osama bin Laden was supposedly whacked in Pakistan by a special team of Navy SEALs, with none other than our illustrious Mungoid-in-chief watching on some kind of live monitor. Well, whoop-de-doo. To be frank, my first reaction is that this whole thing is some kind of 2012 re-election stunt. It just reeks of being staged. But there's still a lot of details that aren't clear, and I suppose we'll have to wait for the made-for-TV movie. I myself have always entertained quite a few doubts as to whether Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda even exist, or at least exist as advertised. I find it very strange indeed that this mysterious terrorist organization has so far been able to pull off only one big action in this country, 9/11. And after that, nothing much seemed to happen, except, of course, for Jug Ears and his little Jewish friends passing a whole lot of laws allowing torture and suspending the Constitution, which I personally think was the whole point of 9/11. Yeah, there have been a few incidents, like that Muslim army psychiatrist in Texas going berserk and shooting a bunch of people, but that wasn't Al-Qaeda or any kind of organized terrorist act. That was just one man who couldn't handle being part of a war machine slaughtering and tyrannizing his own people anymore, and so he took individual action. I think by now we all pretty much get that this whole so-called war on terror shtick has been overblown, to say the least. I don't pretend to know what the story is on this bin Laden hit, but unless the whole thing was a DreamWorks production, something like that movie Wag the Dog, presumably the SEALs really did break into some house and gun down some of the occupants, including some guy they say was Osama bin Laden. Anyway, here's Axis Sally to give us her spin on the great bin Laden rub-out.
Hi, guys. Ding dong, the witch is dead. We don't have any word yet from CNN as to whether Osama bin Laden, or whoever the guy was wearing a pair of ruby slippers when the Navy SEALs broke into his home and gunned him down. For the next 3 weeks or so, you might not want to watch any news broadcasts. It's going to be very bad. It's going to be nothing but Osama, 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 and hooray for Obama, our glorious commander-in-chief. Oh, what a big badass nigger Obama is, and won't you just be so lucky and privileged to vote for him in 2012? Ha ha ha, America won, USA, 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 blah, blah, blah. You know the drill. The Jews and the neoconservatives and the Israel Amen Corner and the tub-thumping fools of the Christian religious right like Pat Robertson, and unfortunately, a lot of white Americans who still don't get what's been going on for the last 10 years are all going to be having an epileptic seizure in the media, screaming, howling, cackling, going booga 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 with wild, hysterical, frenzied joy and hatred against Muslims, the only dark-skinned minority that white Americans are allowed to hate. We're not allowed to hate niggers or Mexicans or Somalis or Vietnamese or any of the minorities who are actually doing us so much harm, but on special occasions, white boys can get a permission slip from the Jews to hate Muslims for a while. It's going to drive you guys who do understand what's going on absolutely bonkers. Jews are not good winners, and neither are Democrats. I'm going to miss all the coverage of Lindsay Lohan and Charlie Sheen and American Idol. I'd rather watch that rubbish than put up with all the Jewish triumphalism we're about to be subjected to. Of course, already the questions are starting to emerge, like why the so-called burial at sea? If the Navy SEALs could extract bin Laden's body out of a house in Pakistan as far as a U.S. naval vessel, why not just bring the whole body home so there can never be any question as to its identity? Why go to all this trouble to make Barack Obama look big and badass and then dump the greatest proof of Obama's triumph in the drink? They say they took a DNA sample, but again, why not just bring the whole carcass home like any good old boy with a deer tied to his fender? Americans don't want to see a scientist's report on a DNA sample, they want to see a dead body. Unless, of course, the dead guy happens to look absolutely nothing like the real Osama bin Laden. If that was the case, then all of a sudden the reasons for the burial at sea become clear. One of the aspects of this that worries me is that we will sink even more into the slough of despondency than we normally do. I'm concerned that we will fall into this trap of believing Zog's own swaggering and boasting about how they're invincible and nobody can ever defeat them. I'm worried that some of us might decide that Francis Fukuyama was right, that this is the end of history, that Zog is forever, that nothing can stop the Jews and the liberals and the neocons. I'm disturbed that some of us might fall back into the old defeatist mindset about how Jewish rule is eternal and it's all hopeless and the dumbass goyim are going to flock to the polls in 18 months and re-elect the stinking nigger in a landslide because some Navy SEALs allegedly shot and killed an old man in some house in Pakistan, and this constitutes some kind of proof that Jewish power is eternal and it's hopeless to resist. This is no exaggeration. Harold gets emails like that all the time. There seem to be an awful lot of people in the movement who are suspiciously willing to get all depressed and defeatist at the drop of a hat. It's like they're actually looking for an excuse to quit. Anyway, here's where I'm supposed to give you some rousing speech about how it's always darkest before the dawn, climb every mountain, dream the impossible dream, onward and upward, better living through chemistry, so forth and so on. Well, that never works, so I'll concentrate on some practical advice on how to deal with the hordes of screaming, howling Jews and tub-thumping Christian Zionists you're going to be seeing and hearing everywhere for the next few weeks. Number one, turn off the TV, which is just plain a good idea anyway. There's nothing on that idiot box that you need to be watching. Either avoid newspapers or strictly refuse to read Osama-related Jewish triumphalist stories, and insofar as possible, simply avoid the whole zoo. There is nothing that you can do about it, and the stress and elevated blood pressure and frustration and anger isn't worth it. Don't rub your own nose in Jewish garbage. Don't worry, American attention spans are very short, and Charlie Sheen and American Idol will be back at the forefront in no time. Number two, are you tired of the world as it is? Well, you've been told what you have to do about it. For some years now, Harold Covington has been telling you what the solution is. It is entirely your fault if you're not part of it. Either get your ass in gear and start working on Northwest migration, or if you're already in the homeland, you can start working to get the Northwest Front's message to the white people who live here. If you're not going to do those things, then quit your bitching about how bad things are. If you're not part of the solution, you're part of the problem. Seriously, guys, this is really just a hiccup. Osama, or whoever it was the SEALs killed, was important to his people and his religion as a symbol, but one man alone can't organize a resistance movement and foment a revolution by himself. Ask Harold. He's been trying for years. It could be that this is a blessing in disguise. Since mighty red, white, and blue America has now killed the evil Osama, there will be less and less excuse for American troops staying in Iraq and Afghanistan. There will be less and less excuse for Janet Napolitano making people walk through naked body scanners at airports, and a lot of Americans will start to ask, okay, Osama's dead now, so when can we get back to normal, and what's with the $5 a gallon gasoline? We won't get out of Iraq and Afghanistan, of course, because Osama bin Laden had nothing to do with why we're there in the first place. We are there to steal the oil and protect the Jews in Israel from the consequences of their own behavior. And Osama dead or Osama alive, Israel isn't going to change. When life hands you a lemon, make lemonade. I suggest you netheads out there try to start a campaign to the effect of, okay, we got Osama, now let's get the hell out. It will give you something to do while you chug down those cold ones that you bought with the money that should have gone into your Northwest Migration Savings account.
We had a meeting here in the Seattle area this weekend, and I got a lot of good response on my policy of delving into our movement's history and giving modern-day people who are just coming into the white racial scene an overview of our past, and yes, we do have one. The general opinion seems to be that I can only rant and rave and try to get you guys to pack the moving van for so long, and you'll either get it or you won't. And when you do get it, it probably won't be anything I say or do that causes you to finally make the decision to come home. It'll be something the niggers or the government or politically correct society does to you. Anyway, I found this old sound clip on YouTube from the late Commander George Lincoln Rockwell from his 1965 campaign for governor of Virginia. The sound quality isn't as good as it might be, and I actually don't know who the commentator at the end of the clip is. I seem to recall that Rockwell got about 10,000 votes, but considering the fact that he had less than $1,000 in campaign funds and nothing but a rickety old school bus and a handful of campaign workers, the publicity he generated was worth it. I've met a lot of old Rockwell guys from that period, and the one thing they all remember more than almost anything else is that campaign for governor.
United States of America, there is only one group, only one, with the courage and the guts to face up to the fact that this battle is racial. It has nothing to do with politics or economy, free enterprise, taxes. It is a question of is this country going to be dominated and run by the white Christian people who built it? Or is it going to be run and dominated by a bunch of beatnik scum, Negroes, Jews, communists, aliens, and no good people who are trying to take it away from us and tell us that we mustn't even talk about this because it's hate? Well, I don't see anything hateful about defending your home and country and family from aliens who are invading and taking it away from you. And that's what they're doing. The same problem happened in Germany. And one man was able to rise up and unite his people as white people. He said the white people are a master race. That's what Adolf Hitler preached, and I believe it. And I think most white Christians in America who have any sense realize that's true. The Jews have been telling us that Adolf Hitler was a monster, and he murdered a lot of people and so forth. I learned that that's a lot of garbage. Just like they say the people of Alabama, stormtroopers, and being Negroes, and villains, and heels, and so forth. That's not true. The same people that lie about Alabama lie about Germany. In short, Germany was the Mississippi and the Alabama of Europe. And they got me and millions of other white Christians like me to go out and try to destroy it. And I think we made a mistake, ladies and gentlemen. I think we should have destroyed atheistic, Soviet, race-mixing communism, which is what Hitler was trying to do. We didn't, however, and now we have it all over us, climbing all over us and destroying us and boasting they're going to bury us. Well, I say to you that it's just the other way around. We're going to bury communism. And I believe that only a leader and only a group that's willing to face up to the whole truth, not part of it, but all of it, is going to be able to bury communism. To do it, we need the strength of the enormous masses of the people of America, not right-wingers, such as voted for Goldwater. We need the white Christian masses, the only group in the country, with the courage and the guts to go after these masses, is the American Nazi Party. No matter what they call us, no matter what they say about us, we believe in the people, in the ordinary taxi drivers, the construction workers, the ordinary little guys that built this country. We believe that if we go to them with a pitch based on the truth, on the facts about race, on the facts about communism, and tell them the truth as we know it, and don't try to hide it or disguise it any, we believe we can win political power because those little fellows will go into the ballot boxes and the ballot booths where there's nobody can see what they're doing, and no matter how much they may be terrorized outside in that sacred American ballot box, they'll vote for a white man. They did it for Wallace. I believe they'll do it for me in Virginia. I believe they'll do it for me or any other leader with the courage to stand up and fight as a white man in this country. So far, ladies and gentlemen, look at the leaders we've had. We've had some very great ones. I would have gladly given my life following Douglas MacArthur. And I offered to fight and do anything for Joe McCarthy. And yet not one of these men, ever once, had the nerve to stand up and say, I am a white man, and I'm going to fight as a white man. Even George Wallace today is still saying racism is evil. And I believe that if we keep saying this for the benefit of the Jews so they won't call us hate-mongers and racists, we're going to get whipped. I believe the time is too short. Time is desperate. It is time to stand up and tell the whole truth. And to fight for it. to organize, not as conservatives, not as Republicans, not as Democrats, not as liberals, not as Northerners, not as Southerners, not as Protestants, or religious or anti-religious or anything else, but as white men. Stand up with all our hearts and soul, and unite. The blacks vote black, the Jews vote Jewish. Ladies and gentlemen, let's let the white man vote white. Let's let the white man support the white cause. If you believe in and understand what I've been preaching, please, won't you support us? Won't you enable these young men who go out and risk their lives in the streets fighting communists? Won't you support them? Keep them alive. Help them pay the bail the way the communists and the Jews support their communist Jew scum to get them out of jail. I've got a lot of men in jail right now. Won't you please support them? Listen to the group leader who has presented this film and give them all the help you can. It will be deeply appreciated by me and every other white American, every white Christian in this country. I thank you very much, and I hope to see you all personally sometime.
Though Rockwell's dream of a politically viable American Nazi Party, complete with a national headquarters building, remained on the drawing board, his legacy is still felt throughout the National Socialist Movement. His books, stories, audio tapes, and pamphlets are still sold and quoted by many politically active souls who look to his words and actions for guidance. His Americanized version of Adolf Hitler's National Socialism is carried on by many of the so-called skinheads and a variety of right-wing splinter groups that profess the faith that is National Socialism.
This week, for our music breaks, we're going to be showcasing the Swedish singer Saga. I've already played a number of her songs on here, such as Tomorrow Belongs to Me and The Snowfell in English. But as might be expected, most of Saga's repertoire is in her native language. This is called Valkyrian, the Song of the Valkyries.
Viking are
This next email comes from Rich in Canada. Dear Harold, can you tell us how us Canadians are supposed to go about coming home to the Northwest? What's the likelihood of being able to come home and stay permanently? Well, first off, we hope to add the Canadian provinces of British Columbia and Alberta to the Northwest homeland when the time comes. Now, we haven't had much luck so far with getting Northwest Front Canada going. We had a real good man in Comrade Jeff Hughes, but the RCMP murdered him in October 2009. And then we had a really good married couple for a while who looked like they might pick up the ball. But now they have a child on the way and they simply can't devote the kind of time and effort necessary to make NF Canada a reality. Nor would I ask a young couple with a newborn child to take that kind of risk in any case, in view of what happened to their predecessor. But the way I read your email, Rich, you may be referring to coming home to the actual homeland itself, here in Washington, Oregon, Idaho, and Montana. Okay, back in July, I went over the U.S. immigration thing for the benefit of our comrades in Europe and elsewhere who want to come here. I went into it in some detail in the Radio Free Northwest for July the 1st, 2010. And so what I recommend you do is go to our party website at www.northwestfront.org and download that particular episode, that's July the 1st, 2010, where I discuss immigration issues, and give that a listen. Just to recap quickly what I said in that podcast, American immigration law is so incredibly complex and detailed that even ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents themselves, don't understand it. It's like our IRS here, the Internal Revenue Service. American tax law is also so incredibly complex that even IRS agents themselves don't understand it, and both the IRS and the ICE retain huge staffs of specialized attorneys whose sole duty is to explain the law to their own employees. Now, basically, though, it runs like this. If you want to stay in this country, first thing you have to do is get past the airport. Whatever you do, do not do like the heretical two did and walk up to the first cop you see in Los Angeles International and ask for political asylum. It's not like Europe here, where asking for asylum gets you an automatic 2 or 3 years in the country in a basket full of welfare goodies. The heretical two got about 14 months in an American prison, and then they got sent back to the UK, where they're still in the slammer. Although I understand one of them was recently released to a halfway house, where the conditions are so restrictive that he is effectively still in prison. Those 7-year sentences, by the way, were for the so-called crime of publishing a Robert Crumb cartoon on a server hosted in the United States. You have to get into the country on some kind of visa, even if it's only a tourist visa, so that you're not completely illegal. And then you have to retain an attorney and start playing the system. Or you can jump through the 112 hoops necessary to immigrate here legally, which starts off by getting yourself an advanced degree in astrophysics, or becoming a brain surgeon, or learning to bounce or hit a ball real good. A white skin is a positive bar to immigration to the USA, and even being rich and famous won't necessarily cut it. There are certain famous British actors and actresses who have been living and working in America for years and who own homes here, but who still can't get actual green cards and have to fly home to London for a week or so every 180 days when their temporary visa expires. Anyway, long story short, immigration to the United States can be done, but it is a royal pain in the ass. Okay, during the second and third segments of the show, I'm going to broach a couple of sensitive topics. First, here's an email from a guy named Frank, and I don't know where he's from, but he raises an issue that I've addressed before, and unfortunately, one I'll probably have to address again in the future, and address again, and again, and again. Dear HAC, your shows are getting better. Your analysis of the judge's ruling on suppressing key evidence in the Steele trial was excellent. Otherwise, I think your show, I think it was April the 21st, but I'm not sure, in which you discussed the Iron Dream, was the best yet I've heard from you. I often had the same reactions, frankly, to certain radio shows that Hal Turner put on. Then it came out that Turner was just a very, very good actor at his trial. After Obama was elected, the Justice Department turned on Turner. This revelation came when Turner's own attorney announced in open court that Turner was in fact a super-secret FBI informer, so he could not be guilty of what the prosecution was accusing him of. Because Turner's attorney introduced official FBI documents proving that Turner was a Fed, Zog could not deny it. Instead, the FBI just got up on the witness stand and washed their hands of Turner, and a jury full of niggers eventually convicted him anyway, although it took a couple of trials. This was traumatizing to the white nationalist world. We had thought, or I had thought, that Turner really was true blue, really one of us, but it wasn't true. I really hope that you are not a Zog informer, but after the Hal Turner object lesson in FBI skullduggery, it is very, very hard to know who the good guys are. You do have lots of baggage, and lots of key leaders in the movement over the last several decades have said that they thought you were a Zog agent, signed Frank. Now, before some of you guys send me all the usual groans to the effect of, oh no, Harold, you're bigger than this. You should be a big man and just ignore all this stuff. You're just perpetuating it. You're wasting our time. Nobody wants to hear it, and so forth and so on. Yeah, I get what these comrades are saying. I understand why they feel that way, and they do have a certain point. I know nobody wants to hear it. I don't want to hear it. I don't want to waste my time with it. But I have to take the attitude that it's not a problem until it's a problem. The intention of the people who are engaging in certain kinds of internet behavior is to cause doubt and confusion. And the very fact that someone like Frank can send me an email like I just read indicates that it's becoming enough of a problem so that I have to deal with it. And the fact is that I've been more or less ignoring this happy horse shit for decades, and I got a hot flash for you folks. It doesn't go away if you pretend it doesn't exist. Problems never do. Pretending a problem doesn't exist never solves anything. If you don't answer all these bizarre allegations, then people don't think, oh, what a big man Harold is. Harold won't stoop to conquer. People aren't that intelligent and fair and broad-minded. People simply assume that you don't answer them because you can't answer the goo-boo crap. And that's how these stories, like so-called white leaders denouncing me, pass into the subculture's narrative as the truth. Just like Columbus discovered America, George Washington chopped down the cherry tree, and Bill Clinton grew up as a poor sharecropper's son in Arkansas. Now, in actual fact, none of those things happened. But most people believe they did because they've never been told the truth. Now, by the way, that business of me being denounced as an informer or agent or whatever by so-called white leaders isn't true. The only so-called white leaders of any genuine stature who have ever quote-unquote denounced me were Tom Metzger and William Pierce, both of whom were upset because I leveled specific public criticisms against them regarding specific and proven incidents of behavior on their part. And so they conducted a lifelong smear campaign against me in retaliation. I remember, this is the movement where the concepts of loyal opposition and constructive criticism simply don't exist, and the slightest criticism or hint that someone may be wrong is cause for a lifelong blood feud. Right now, there is an internet campaign against the Northwest Front going on, a campaign which will be with us for a long time. Now, the purpose of this is not even so much to smear me personally. They've kind of given up on that, because for a movement personality, goat dancing bullshit aside, in reality, my closet is in fact remarkably free of skeletons, much more so than just about anybody else's, certainly more so than the people who attack me. The purpose of the internet and whispering campaign is to spread just enough doubt and confusion about the Northwest Imperative to keep you from coming here. You see, the enemy knows that you know that you should be coming here, but you don't really want to, and you're just looking for some way to rationalize that self-interested decision on some kind of white nationalist political grounds. See, Harold, he's just kind of dodgy. There's all these stories about him. And, you know, 20 years ago, you know, Tom Metzger said something bad about him. So we just can't really go Northwest because, Harold's just too much of a dubious character and that kind of thing. They have to come up with stuff like that because I is gonna stand and fight doesn't really cut it anymore, because it's becoming pretty obvious that nobody's actually doing any standing or any fighting in Wisconsin or Florida or New Jersey, wherever, and nobody has any intention of doing so. So that excuse for not coming Northwest is wearing a little thin. Cass Sunstein in the White House and his buddies at the ADL and the SPLC have figured out that most white nationalists in America are coming to recognize that the Northwest is the only way, and they're starting to grapple in their own minds with their racial duty to come here to the homeland, as reluctant as they are to lay down the remote and haul their tired asses up off the sofas in Texas and New York and Tennessee and Arizona. But Sunstein and his people also understand that white American nationalists are still American whites. And like all American white people, they're lazy, unfocused, dysfunctional, and inclined instinctively to take the line of least resistance. It's what they've been taught all their lives to do. American white nationalists know that they should be packing that moving van and getting their pale butts up here, but they don't really want to. They want to keep on sitting on the sofa, chugging a brewski, and cursing at CNN, and ending every night crying in their beer, "Oh, why doesn't somebody do something?" Although, of course, by now, they probably no longer listen to Radio Free Northwest at all, because I keep asking them the same question. It's too much work and trouble and inconvenience, and it does involve some element of risk to come home, and white Americans have been conditioned from birth to avoid risk at all costs, while simultaneously making up rationales and excuses to convince themselves and others that they're avoiding risk for reasons other than laziness and cowardice. It's a kind of Orwellian doublethink. We both know that most of you aren't going to pack that moving van and come to the Northwest because you're either too damn scared or too damn lazy. But you can't admit it even to yourself, so you got to make up this elaborate structure of rationalization as to why you're not coming. Now, the people who are doing this internet stalking and crap and who are perpetuating this have come to understand that they don't really need to run these stupid whole websites calling me names like they used to do, accusing me of buggering circus animals and practicing black magic and that kind of stuff. That's just so 1990s, and it's too crude, and it hasn't stopped me. And I repeat, it's no longer me they're trying to stop. It's you. I think they've accepted the fact that they can't keep me off the internet, finally. Back in 1997 and 1998, they used to cancel my ISP every week or 10 days, trying to drive me off the net. Now, they've come to realize that you can't really keep anybody off the internet who wants to be there. They've also come to realize that instead of dumping a whole bucket of toxic waste over people's heads, all they have to do is provide that little poison drip, drip, drip of doubt and question and suspicion. A comment on a blog here, a little needling remark there, etc., etc. No, these smears and slanders and little needling defamatory remarks are no longer directed at me. They're directed at you, trying to confuse and demoralize you and make sure that you stay firmly planted in your seat and don't go anywhere near the Pacific Northwest. You will notice that the solutions that these internet hecklers offer in place of the Northwest migration, when they offer any at all, which isn't very often, but they all seem to involve you remaining in your seat and tapping on a computer keyboard, with no element of actual physical real-world activity at all, except maybe once or twice a year, you drive across 3 to 5 states to get to some meeting in a rented motel banquet room where there'll be about 75 people, mostly people with gray and white heads, and everyone will bitch and moan a bit, and you eat some rubber chicken, and then a couple of guys make a couple of speeches bitching and moaning about the Federal Reserve and Obama, and then you go out into the dark parking lot and begin the long drive home. I don't know where our comrade Frank, who asked this question, is from, but he's not in the homeland. And Sunstein and the ADL and the SPLC know he's not coming to the homeland so long as he's worried that I might be another Hal Turner. Indeed, I've often theorized that one of the reasons that the feds did what they did with Hal Turner, acknowledging in public that he was an informant in a courtroom, which is actually very unusual for them, I think that was done deliberately in order to create this very kind of paranoia about me and other legitimate white nationalist personalities. Now, as to the question itself, how do I prove that I'm not some deep cover FBI informant or provocateur? Well, Frank, I don't know. I really don't. How do you prove a negative? I got a better one for you. How do you prove a 43-year-old negative? Now, some time ago, my own brother, who is apparently a very bitter and disappointed man in life, made a number of public allegations to the effect that I did certain things and certain things happened in the years 1968 and 1969, things which he knows perfectly well did not occur in real life, and which he also knows that I can never, ever disprove, and which will therefore enter into the whole anti-Covington and anti-Northwest narrative as fact. Now, how the hell do I prove that something did not happen 43 years ago? I can't. How the hell do I prove that I am not some kind of government plant? Prove it sufficiently to someone's satisfaction that they'll overcome their doubts, pack that moving van, and come home to take their place in their racial destiny. Especially, how do I prove it in the face of the Hal Turner case? Now, for those of you who are still shaking your heads and saying, Harold, you shouldn't be talking about this at all. You shouldn't be giving them the satisfaction. I have to say that Frank has a completely legitimate point when he talks about Hal Turner. In the face of a horrible public example like that, Frank and others in this movement have the right to ask this of me and anybody else. And I'm damned if I know how I can prove that I'm not a spy or an agent provocateur or whatever. My first instinct is just to ask you to sit down and read all four of my novels, Frank, if you haven't done so already. One guy who read them and who entertained the same kind of doubts you seem to have emailed me after he had finished the quartet, and he said, quote unquote, Harold, if you're some kind of FBI agent, I'm going to write to the Bureau and ask them to send us 50 more agents like you. Now, I could point out some differences between me and Turner. Turner was always yelling and hollering for violence, any kind of violence. Oh, white people have to riot in the streets. They have to burn down federal buildings. They have to kill, kill, kill. Now, those of you who heard Turner's broadcasts and remember them know what I'm talking about. Now, do I say that? No, I don't. Do I need to play my Joe Stack tribute yet again to make my attitude towards individual acts of violence and destruction of property clear? I can sum that up for you in three words. Don't do it. A white man or woman does nobody any good in prison, and staying out of prison is one of your primary duties as a white nationalist. Would an FBI agent or a provocateur say that? FBI and SPL spies are supposed to put white men into prison, not keep them out. Now, how many people have I testified against in court over the past 40 years? Ever. I will tell you. Zero, goose egg, zip, nada, nix. Who has gone to prison because of my testimony? Same answer. Zero, zip, nada, nobody. You hear, oh, Harold's an informer. Who did I inform on? When? Where? Name a specific case. You can't, because nothing of the kind ever happened. If I'm an FBI informant, I'm not doing much to earn my pay. Now, Hal Turner's agitation to white violence never had any real objective other than burn, baby, burn. If you've read the Northwest novels, you'll understand that the Northwest migration does, in fact, have a simple and achievable political objective. We're not out to kill anybody. We're out to free a people and create a new nation. I especially do not call out people by name and give out their addresses and home phone numbers like federal judges in Obongo's hometown of Chicago, of all places, and say, hey, dudes, Judge so-and-so lives at such-and-such an address. Why don't you guys go kill him and burn down his house? Now, that's what finally got Hal Turner arrested, FBI agent provocateur or not. Turner apparently let all of those years of doing whatever the hell he wanted to do and saying whatever the hell he wanted to say without any restrictions get to his head. Now, if you listen to this podcast regularly, you will note that I don't do anything like that, and I won't do anything like that. The late Pastor Robert Miles once told me, quote unquote, Harold, if and when the real thing ever comes along, the people in this movement won't recognize it at first. And when they do, they'll do everything in their power to destroy it. Looks like Bob was right. In Europe, it is illegal to be a white nationalist or a national socialist. And anyone saying even one-tenth of what I say in an average weekly episode of Radio Free Northwest would be arrested and sent to prison. And that includes Sweden, the home country of the white nationalist singer Saga. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing this right in Swedish, but this song is called Yttrandefrihet, Freedom of Speech. This is Saga.
Say a few to me. What an animal bara. Vad får tänka fria tankar. Och att själv få svara. Sverige vaknar. pratar vi. För yttrandet, friheten, den blåser vi nu till strid. Sverige, vakna upp nu, kampen ska ta vid. För yttrandet, friheten, den blåser vi nu till strid. Ett mot folket kallas, lagligt slår oss med, vider oss med hammaren. Kulturen stär, grundlagen förnekas, så väger mycket lätt. För ockupanter och förrädare i Sverige skipare. Sverige vakna upp nu, kampen ska ta vid. För yttrandefriheten blåser vi nu till strid. Sverige vakna upp nu, kampen ska ta vid. För yttrandefriheten blåser vi nu till strid. Sverige vaknar upp nu, kampen ska ta vid. För yttrandefriheten blåser vi nu till strid. Sverige vaknar upp nu, kampen ska ta vid. För yttrandefriheten.
Now the second topic I want to bring up. Last week, Axis Sally did a piece on the Jews in which she made some positive references to Christianity, and that set the goat dance off again in full bah. Now, I apologize once again for taking up podcast time with stuff that's frankly pretty silly, but I say again, as grotesque as it is, the fact is that this stuff does indeed matter. It creates confusion and doubt among us in a time when we need to develop a laser-like focus on securing the existence of our people and a future for white children. And my guess is that every dozen podcasts or so, I'm going to have to lay aside more important stuff and deal with this gibberish, because it's not going to stop. I wish I didn't have to, but frankly I consider this to be an enemy attack on the NF and the concept of the Northwest American Republic, despite whatever may actually motivate these people. And part of my job description is defending the Northwest Imperative against enemy attacks. I'd far rather be doing this against people like Rachel Maddow and Arianna Huffington and John Stewart, but we're not on that level yet. One day we will be, but right now I have to stomp on cockroaches when I'd rather be hunting bear, so to speak. Now, one of the accusations leveled against me by certain people who are obsessed to the point of derangement over all the toxic little ins and outs of the 1990s movement is that I am allegedly a secret Christian, and I'm part of some Christian plot to do down Dr. Pierce, blah, 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 ishkabibble. Now, these accusations are usually of the pardon the crayon, they don't let us have anything sharp here variety. But I inadvertently made a slip recently that will no doubt set the dervishes to whirling again. This comment by Axis Sally last week apparently proves, in what passes for their minds, that I am part of some strange Christian conspiracy to, quote-unquote, take over the movement. Although why Christians or anyone else would want to take over the movement remains almost as great a mystery as the question of what movement. Right, let's hold our noses and leap right into this one. First off, what Sally was doing was reading an adaptation from an article that I myself wrote many years ago, almost 20 years ago, in fact. So any complaints need to be directed against me and not her. Secondly, I wrote that piece, which was called Race Relations in America, as a pamphlet for the Council of Conservative Citizens chapter in Kentucky. Hence the favorable references to Christianity in view of the target audience. Now, this was back in pre-internet hand distribution days, remember, and this piece was designed for mass consumption. I think about 25,000 were printed and actually passed out by the late Joe High and his boys. I've always had difficulty explaining to non-Southerners that it simply is not a good idea to pass out literature to working-class people in the South, and especially in the Appalachian Mountains, claiming that Jesus was a dead Jew on a stick and that Christ was a homosexual getting it on with his disciples. That kind of thing does not serve to put one on a credible basis of communication with the locals. Now, for some reason, having nothing to do with anything in the real world, some of the more manic among us refuse to give up such efforts under any circumstances, including total failure. Anyway, that's why the pro-Christian references in the text. I've reprinted the entire article, Race Relations in America, on the Thought Crime blog at http://downwithjugears.blogspot.com. Now, that's the updated 1998 version, so you can read the original or as close as I can get. Now, that's the post for April the 29th. The original Kentucky Council of Conservative Citizens 1990s version was printed, and I don't think any copies exist on the internet. Now, let me run down my views on the whole religion thing. The first thing we all have to understand is that it is an issue which cannot be resolved. Man has been trying to fathom the workings of the divine ever since he first crawled out of the caves, and he hasn't succeeded yet to any noticeable degree. Our tiny little movement isn't going to be able to do what 7,000 years of human thought and mysticism has failed to do, and we shouldn't even try. That's not why we're here. We are here to secure the existence of our people and a future for white children. We are a political and racial movement, not a religion. And not once in the past 40 years have I observed someone on one side of this argument convince someone on the other side. We simply end up screaming and cursing at each other, and we have more than enough excuses to do that already. Now, I'm not going to go into my personal religious views because they're irrelevant, and they would simply add one more element of goo-boo to the whole issue. For those of you who are interested, I did get into it a little in my interview with the Occidental Quarterly about 18 months ago, the one that was banned by the conservatives on the board of directors, because I also made positive references to National Socialism. If anyone wants to read that, let me know and I'll send you a copy. I also posted a section from my novel, A Mighty Fortress, on the same blog I just referred to, and that makes my position clear. Check that out as well. Now, right now, I'm going to address this on purely pragmatic grounds, which should govern every decision that a revolutionary makes. Now, within the realities of this thing of ours, the following facts stand out. The overwhelming majority of white people in this country at least nominally profess some form of Christianity. Okay, admittedly, with most of our people, it's only skin deep, and in some of them, not even that. Ambrose Bierce once described a Christian as someone who follows the teachings of Jesus Christ, insofar as they're not inconsistent with a life of sin. But most ordinary white people simply will not tolerate outright and often scatological attacks against Christianity as a whole. Before you can convince people, you have to put yourself on a credible basis of communication with them. And no one's going to be able to do that by referring to Jesus as a dead Jew on a stick. Now, God knows we have enough problems with the racial and Jew thing in dealing with our own people, and we don't need to throw religion into the mix. Not now, anyway. It makes us look like cranks and kooks, and we have to stop coming across like that. The Christians have the money and are far more willing to donate it than the anti-Christians. If that sounds crass and greedy, so be it. The implications here are obvious, and you are all quite capable of understanding why this must be an extremely important consideration in everything we do from A to Z. Now, there's another issue. Let me pick my words carefully here. We all know by now that the people who gravitate to our movement have a certain tendency to what I will politely term dysfunctional personalities. Now, this characteristic has always been extremely prominent in the violently anti-Christian elements. Frankly, I've always observed that the most violent anti-Christians among us are often the nuttiest. Their hatred of Christianity is more often than not just a gut thing. It's not based on any genuine philosophy or alternate religious beliefs. I'm not talking here about genuine pagans or Odinists or Wiccans or anyone who has an honest-to-God different religious belief from Christianity. I'm talking about a hatred of Christianity that amounts to an obsession which eventually overrides every consider of race, practicality, or sense of proportion. They are anti-Christians first and white racialists by a long second or third. Now, any public attack on Christianity by a white racial group or personality or tendency, or any private attack, which will eventually become public since we're utterly incapable of resisting infiltration or keeping a secret, is political suicide, and we need to stop committing political suicide. Whether we like it or not, the overwhelming majority of white Americans at least verbally profess some kind of Christianity, and they will not tolerate or support views that they consider to be blasphemous. That is the reality, and we had damned well better internalize that reality fast and counter it as best we can, or at least refrain from attacking Christianity anywhere somebody like Morris Dees or the media can track it down and broadcast it. And there is a very distinct difference between the Christian religion as practiced by our forefathers for many centuries and the organized churches of today. And one of the marks of the obsessive anti-Christian is an absolute manic refusal to acknowledge this clear fact under any circumstances. Now, these liberal churches with women ministers and faggot weddings and money-raising activities for nigger murderers around the world are quite clearly in violation of the Bible and the tenets of their own supposed religion. They've simply elected to ignore the moral dictates of the religion that they profess to believe in. Liberal Christianity consists of the Sermon on the Mount, twisted and distorted into almost unrecognizable forms, and virtually nothing else. Many liberal churches use the Bible itself only sparingly, and the Old Testament not at all. For them, Christianity is a buffet. They take what they like and they leave the rest. I would be entirely happy to see Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson boiled in oil. You get no argument from me there, but they're not Christians, they're Zionists. The position of the Northwest Front must be to have no position on religion insofar as we can get away with it, but to occasionally send a few signals to the Christians that we're not hostile to them on religious grounds, and we represent no threat to them. Of course, silly me, I haven't yet given up any hope that someday we may be able to build a real movement instead of a Three Stooges farce. Now, as far as this idea that I am part of some Christian conspiracy to destroy Dr. Pierce's legacy, I tell you what, let's let Dr. Pierce himself talk about his own religion.
In my religion, the first commandment is survive, be fruitful and multiply, grow strong, and safeguard the future of your children. And the second commandment is seek the future among your own kind. Know that each race of man, each species of animal, must develop according to its own laws, according to its own nature. Understand the nature of your own people and base your plans for the future, your plans for growing strong, your plans for a strong and healthy posterity on that nature. Preserve your kind. My religion is a racist religion. It does not require me to hate anyone of another race or to harm anyone of another race so long as he does not threaten or impede my own race. But it does require me always to put the interests of my own people ahead of any other race's interests or any individual's interest, including my own. My religion is based on doing what comes naturally, on doing what my kind always have done, at least what they did prior to the mass insanity which seems to have taken hold during this century. When we did what was natural for our people, we grew strong, and no other people could stand against us.
I couldn't have said it any better myself. Anyway, I better clam up now before I really lose it. This is Saga.
It's gotta be, yeah.
Right, it's time for the Edgar Steele trial update. Now, to begin with, I should report that both Cindy Steele and Ed's 20-year-old daughter, Kelsey, have taken the stand, and they've testified quite clearly to the jury of 11 women and one man that neither of them believes Ed to be guilty of attempting to hire Larry Fairfax as a hitman. Both of them have stated flat out that they were aware of Edgar's internet contacts with a number of women in the Ukraine as part of his research for a book he was writing on the sex slave trade, which is run largely by Israeli Jews, as have several of Edgar's friends and acquaintances, and sometimes, apparently, Cindy and Kelsey watched over his shoulder as he conducted online chats with these women. Now, that right there should blow the whole idea of motive out the window if there were any common sense applicable to these entire proceedings, but I think we know that's not the case. You may recall that the U.S. government originally claimed that Ed's motive was to collect a large life insurance settlement on the lives of his wife and his mother-in-law, but they had to scramble to rearrange that theory when they found out that Steele had canceled all his policies and there was no insurance. The U.S. attorney then confronted Cindy with a phone call Ed made from the jail, wherein he allegedly tried to tamper with her testimony, and Cindy stated that she understood that her husband was trying to tell her that he was innocent, which is entirely consistent with the brief snippets of the conversation I've heard played on the media. I might add that the whole question of how a vital piece of evidence in a court proceeding ended up in the hands of the media in the first place, who then broadcast the tape publicly in a clear effort to poison the jury pool, is a subject which has been pointedly avoided by the government during the trial. One interesting section, which was not played beforehand by the media, indicated that Ed was under the impression that his conversation with his wife was covered by the legal doctrine of spousal privilege, which explains to me why he did such a seemingly reckless thing as to talk about the case with her on a phone that he knew was being recorded. Needless to say, the court simply ignored spousal privilege, which federal courts do whenever they feel like it. Larry Fairfax's story is that although he accepted money from Steele, he never intended to kill anyone, and he told the FBI about the plot because he was afraid Steele would kill him if he didn't agree. So, let me get this straight. Fairfax was afraid of a tiny little old man who had just come out of open-heart surgery and who was as weak as a kitten. Yeah, sure, Larry. That bit reminds me of the cartoon Courage the Cowardly Dog. What I still don't get is why Fairfax allegedly went straight to the FBI and not the local police, which would seem to be the more logical place to go to report a crime in Idaho, but that's another question that never seems to have been asked, at least according to the media reports I've seen. The defense was at least able to touch on one key point, and that was that Fairfax had stolen silver from the Steeles and set up the murder plot to cover the theft. Now, one weird development is that the federal judge is reviewing Larry Fairfax's handwritten notes to determine if the defense lawyers are entitled to the material. Now, you would think that this would be obvious. It's called discovery, and these notes should have been made available to the defense from the get-go, but apparently the defense didn't even know they existed until Fairfax referred to them in court. The prosecution should have disclosed the existence of the notes and handed them over as a matter of pre-trial routine, but as one can imagine, in a political trial like this, the usual procedures are being largely ignored. A windmill, the judge said that he'll review the notes and give the defense relevant material. In other words, he gets to decide what's relevant and what isn't. Jesus. It looked like for a while there was going to be one item of very good news indeed, and that is that the judge reversed himself, and at first he agreed to let at least one of the defense audio experts, George Papkin, testify that the tapes have been altered. Windmill ruled that the testimony provided by Cindy Steele and her daughter, Kelsey Steele, opened the door for testimony from Papkin about whether the recordings had been altered by the federal government. It sounds to me like that defense attorney McAllister the Steele family hired is earning his fee. He clearly used Cindy and Kelsey to get around the judge's outrageous ruling of last week that because the defense had not produced any evidence that the tapes had been altered, they would not be allowed to introduce any evidence that the tapes had been altered. However, unfortunately, I just checked the Free Edgar Steele website, and apparently the judge has effectively changed his mind again. You see, Papkin had already been told that he wasn't going to be allowed to testify, so he went on vacation to Bora Bora, of all places. And the judge said, fine, he can testify so long as he is in the courtroom at 9:30 tomorrow morning, which the judge, of course, knew was absolutely impossible. To my mind, that pretty much tells the whole story right there. This is a frame-up. It is a disgrace. The judge is biased against the defendant, and the judge is assisting the prosecution in sending a man that he has to know to be innocent to prison. It makes me want to vomit. Anyway, according to the media, it's possible that the case may have gone to the jury by the time you folks out there hear this podcast, and so you may already know the verdict, so I'll hold off on any more comments at this time, although I suspect that one way or the other, I'll be letting loose with a real blast next week. Okay, here's where I usually let go with my final rave, in which I exhort all of you to pull your socks up and come home, but what with all the depressing Edgar Steele stuff, I haven't really been able to wind up to it properly, so instead, I'll give you folks a quick Aryan history lesson. The true brave heart of Scotland was not the valiant William Wallace, but his equally bold and more able successor, King Robert the Bruce, who defeated the English at Bannockburn in 1314 and won Scotland's independence. Now, the way the name came about after Bruce's death was as follows. When Bruce died of natural causes after a long life of courageous leadership, as was the custom of the time, his heart was removed, embalmed, and placed in a gold casket. The Bruce had vowed to go on crusade to the Holy Land, but he'd never made it, and his dying wish was that his heart should rest in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem. The man who volunteered to fulfill this dying wish of his king and former commander was Sir James Douglas, also known to history as the Black Douglas, for his ferocity in fighting the English during the Wars of Independence. Now, on the way to the Holy Land, Sir James, warrior that he was, got sidetracked into a battle against the Saracens in Spain, which was at that time still half-occupied by Islam. His small party was surrounded on an open plain by a large force of Muslims, and the Scots were pretty obviously done for. The Black Douglas then took the gold reliquary containing the embalmed heart of Robert the Bruce, and he hurled it as high and as far as he could, right into the masked enemy. Then he drew his sword and shouted, "Lead on, brave heart, in death as ever thou didst in life." He charged into the Muslims and cut his way through his foes left and right until he reached the fallen relic, and he collapsed on top of the small box and died of over a dozen wounds. These are our ancestors, people. These are the men whose legacy we have to live up to, and we can do that. There is no reason on the face of this earth that we can't display the same kind of courage and determination and passionate commitment to freedom that they did. I will say this for the umpteen hundredth time. It's not a matter of whether we can do this. It is a matter of whether we will do it. It's all there waiting for you, people. A free white world and a glorious future. But it comes with a price. Your willingness to pay that price will determine whether there are still any people around on this continent in 100 years who look like us. Well, our time is up, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98194. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andaban. Freedom. Follow in their footsteps of the rising moon.